The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Resuming today, volume 58, number 2, which is the current issue of spring 2019, and it's titled The 1960s, How Does Change Happen? And the first article we'll be reading today is Women's Lib Goes to College. It's written by Rachel F. Seidman, who is director of the Southern Oral History Program at the UNC Center for the Study of the American South and holds adjunct appointments in History, American Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies. Do you ever dream about going to college when you're older? Do you ever imagine what you might pack in your suitcase when you head off to your new campus? Along with your notebooks, pillows, and shampoo, you'll need to pack enough clothes to last a while, including your favorite outfits. What do you think your clothes will say about you, about how you see yourself, how you want others to see you? In the 1950s, if you were a young woman starting school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill at the end of the 1950s, you would receive a copy of the Woman's Handbook, also called Your Guidebook to Life as a Carolina Lady. One section would tell you what you should wear for classes and studying. Khaki skirts and tailored blouses, skirt and sweater combinations, plus loafers and socks. For dates and football games, dresses and heels. Bermudas and toreador pants would be okay for picnics in the spring, but were not allowed in classrooms or libraries. Strict expectations for Carolina co-eds went beyond their clothes. As the packing list revealed, the emphasis was on the need for them to behave as ladies at all times. There were a lot of rules to follow. Rules about how late you could stay out at night, how you had to sign in and out of your dorm, how you had to get permission from your parents to travel away from campus. The official term for the university's approach to its students was in loco parentis, which is Latin for in place of parents. The university saw students as children, whom it needed to protect just as parents would. But many of the rules did not apply to boys. Girls were considered especially fragile, and so they had more rules to follow. Breaking the rules meant a threat to their good reputations and to their ability to stay in school. Over the next decade, major changes took place both on campus and around the university that profoundly reshaped how the university saw young women, and even more important, how young women saw themselves. Those changes were the result of many interlocking causes, but one big one was the movement for women's rights, or what is sometimes known as the feminist movement. Feminist being defined as any person, woman or man, who believes in political, economic, and social equality and equal rights for women. Women of all sorts, young and old, rich and poor, white women and women of color, had been pushing back against the laws that prevented them from participating as full equals to men for more than a century already. The 19th and early 20th century women's movement is most famous for finally winning the right to vote with the 19th Amendment. But its goals were broader than that. Starting in the 1840s, the movement had also called for married women to be able to own their own property and for access to higher education for women, among many other demands. In the 1940s, during World War II, thousands of women entered high-paying factory jobs to fill in for men who had gone off to the war. Those women came to value the financial security and independence those jobs provided. Many did not want to leave their jobs when the men came back from the war. They fought for more equal access to and treatment in the workforce. Women had also been active in peace movements, anti-racist movements, labor movements, and partisan politics for decades. So the feminist movement of the 1960s didn't come out of nowhere, but to many people it felt like it did. Suddenly in the mid-1960s, in towns and cities around the country, there were new conversations happening in homes, in offices, and in organizations. Should men and women be treated differently or the same? Do women have the same intelligence as men? Should women do the same jobs? Sometimes those conversations spread into the streets. Women who had learned how to organize and demonstrate from the civil rights movement marched for new rights for women, demanding equal opportunity and equal treatment before the law. Thousands of other women who had never participated in a demonstration read about them in the newspaper and saw them on TV. Not everyone agreed with the feminists. Many men and women, too, agreed that the woman's proper role was to stay home and take care of the children, and they didn't like the changes they saw happening. But change was indeed coming. Less visible than the street demonstrations, but as important to the rapid spread of the women's liberation movement, especially among young and women, were consciousness-raising groups, sometimes called CR groups. These were small groups of women who met together regularly to discuss how they felt about all these new issues. Often a CR group meeting would be in someone's living room. It might start with women sharing stories from their own personal experiences. For instance, they might talk about how, when they were growing up, sisters and brothers were treated differently in their family. As they went around the circle and shared their stories and heard about how similar experiences many women realized that what they had thought was just unfair in their own home actually represented a larger pattern, an unfairness with the way girls and women were treated in society at large. That made them think about their lives in a different way. Sometimes it made them mad. Sometimes it made them sad. Often, though, they felt excitement in learning to see the world with fresh eyes and in having a new sisterhood with other women who were sharing this experience with them. During the 1960s at UNC Chapel Hill, both women and men started to challenge the idea that the university should treat students in loco parentis. Students protested a variety of rules and insisted they were not children, but adults who could take care of themselves. Since women had been more severely restricted by rules that had applied only to them, the resulting changes were most profound for female students. Because of the women's movement, they could argue that they deserved equal treatment and did not want or need special protection. Over the course of a few years, the whole system at Carolina and at other colleges and universities across the nation changed. Gone were the separate regulations for women and men. Gone was the dean of women's office. Gone were the separate honors courts for men and women. If you arrived on campus in the fall of 1971, there was no more women's handbook. Instead of your guide to being a Carolina lady, you may have found a copy of Notes for Your First Year, a handbook for women. This was a very different kind of guide, published by a local women's liberation group for incoming students. We are writing you a note for your first year, a note that says, "Welcome, sisters." The authors suggested that while the school's official rules and regulations had changed, some things that young women faced were still problematic and might be harder to identify. Discriminatory rules are not blatant but subtle and reinforced by still subtler social norms about women's place in the university. The authors pointed out several important facts: how few women were on the faculty, how there were almost no classes that focused on women's experiences, contributions, or writings. They warned incoming students to watch out for advisors who encouraged them to take easy classes because they didn't believe girls really needed to learn much. Professors who commented on their appearance rather than on their homework. Or anyone who said, "A smart woman never shows her brains." They provided forthright information about sexuality and birth control, and they explained how to get involved in the women's movement and why you might want to. Over the next decade of the 1970s, women activists and their male supporters would continue to push for changes in legal structures and in attitudes and culture. In 1974, the federal legislation Title IX was passed. It ruled that any institution receiving federal funding, like a public university, had to provide equal opportunities and programming for men and women. At the university, that meant women could push for female varsity sports and scholarships, and for greater numbers of women faculty. New publications like She Magazine, newest organizations among students, and the Association of Women Faculty and Professionals set out to monitor the changes and advocate on behalf of women. By the late 1970s, a new women's studies program was founded, allowing students the chance to focus their studies on the experiences of women and the new questions such research generates. But while the 1960s and 1970s saw great progress, there was also a backlash, a sudden negative reaction to a social movement. To the severe disappointment of many feminists in North Carolina, in 1977, the state Senate refused to ratify the National Equal Rights Amendment after a massive anti-feminist rally in Raleigh. That decision effectively killed the chance for the United States Constitution to include the statement, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." For many feminist organizers, this was a devastating blow after the years of hard work lobbying for the amendment. The loss did not wipe out the changes they had accomplished, but it limited what might come next. Today, we can see evidence all around us of the major changes the feminist movement achieved during the 1960s and 70s in education, careers, and family life. But we've also seen recent examples of women's continued fight for change. For example, the 2017 and 2018 women's marches, the hashtag MeToo movement, and much higher numbers of women running for public office and getting elected. Why do you think some women still feel the need for feminism? Why do other people still oppose it? What do you believe still needs to be done? Here are the captions for the photographs that are accompanying this article. Look closely at the people in this photo. It looks like a business party for adults, right? Wrong. These are college students at a party at UNC Chapel Hill in 1961. The image is from Yakety Yak, the school yearbook. Next photo, what a difference 10 years make. This is an image from the 1971 Yakety Yak. Compare the girls in each picture. What is the difference in how they're dressed, in how they are wearing their hair, in how they are behaving? Female students at neighboring UNC Greensboro show off their best hair, outfits, and manners as they pose for a school photo. UNC handbooks for women reflect the changing times for the years 1959, 1968, and 1971. A 1973 cover of She Magazine, a UNC Chapel Hill campus publication started by young women to focus on female students, faculty, and women's issues. By the early 1970s, the women's liberation movement was making big news. The young woman on the cover of this Life magazine, wearing jeans and flashing the peace sign, reflects political and lifestyle changes that were happening among young women on campuses across North Carolina. At NC State University, student body president Kathy Sterling speaks out at a student rally. There's also a sidebar called Think About It. If you were going to write a handbook for girls entering your school, what would you tell them? What has changed for girls and young women since the 1960s? What has not? What has changed for boys and young men? What else do you think needs to change? And there's a quote, "Yeah, some people like to call us radicals or rebels or whatever. We were between the beatniks and the hippies, and we didn't quite fit with either group. So nobody was sure what to call us. But it was very equal, all the civil rights people. The same people who were for blacks' rights were for equal rights for women, too. And they were much aware of that long before it ever became an issue in the national consciousness. Karen L. Parker. Karen L. Parker, the first African-American woman to attend UNC Chapel Hill and the first to earn an undergraduate degree from the university in 1965. The next article is To Right These Wrongs, The Battle to End Poverty in the 1960s by Robert R. Korstad and James L. Laloudis. Robert R. Korstad is Kevin D. Gorder Professor of Public Policy at the Terry Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. James L. Laloudis is Professor of History. Peter T. Grauer, Associate Dean for Honors, Carolina, and Director of the James M. Johnston Center for Undergraduate Excellence at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They have a website, www.torightthesewrongs.com. In the 1950s and early 1960s, many Americans were enjoying a booming consumer economy, but a fifth of the nation struggled to put food on the table or to find adequate housing. In North Carolina, the problem was even worse. Nearly 40% of the population here lived in poverty. Poverty is defined as not having enough money for basic needs such as food, drinking water, and decent shelter. When Terry Sanford campaigned to be elected governor, he promised to usher in a new day in our state. He was elected and served as governor from 1961 to 1965. The North Carolina Fund, established in 1963, was his way of making good on that pledge. Over the next 5 years, the fund operated as a unique, experimental anti-poverty agency. It was, in fact, a model for President Lyndon B. Johnson's national war on poverty. The fund was also shaped by the experiences of World War II veterans who had fought for democracy abroad. They had seen in Nazi Germany a reflection of the racism back home that violated American ideals of justice, freedom, and equality. Many of those veterans, both black and white, returned from the war determined to make the segregated Jim Crow South a better place. In 1964, the fund made grants to 11 community-based anti-poverty projects, 3 in the mountains, 4 in the Piedmont, and 4 down east. To kickstart those projects, the fund also recruited student anti-poverty workers, black and white, from colleges and universities across the state. They were known as the North Carolina Volunteers. These young people lived and worked together in racially integrated teams. During the summers of 1964 and 1965, they traveled to the communities the fund had targeted. There they taught adults to read, tutored school children, repaired houses, built new parks, and helped families in need of food and clothing. Like the fund, the volunteers first tried to uplift poor people by teaching them how to work harder and live better lives. But as the volunteers labored in poor communities, they began to realize that they misunderstood the problem. Poor people were not to blame for their condition. For North Carolinians who were black, poverty was the product of a Jim Crow society that denied them access to education and jobs. And for blacks and whites alike, poverty was part of a North Carolina economy built on low wages. The lesson was clear. Uplift would not end poverty. As one student volunteer explained, that task required instead a radical strategy to stop the exploitation of the poor by the more economically well off. For the North Carolina Fund, this changed everything. In 1965, it began to change course. The fund now emphasized organizing poor people politically, getting them out to vote, and supporting their demands for fair treatment by government officials, landlords, and employers. This new approach ignited a firestorm of opposition. Many local leaders in North Carolina had embraced the fund because of the financial resources, including federal anti-poverty money that it brought to their communities, but they were not eager to give the poor people a political voice. Nor did they intend to challenge what one of Governor Sanford's advisors called the poverty segregation complex, that tangled web of racial discrimination and low wages that impoverish both black and white North Carolinians. In northeastern North Carolina, the fund supported black sharecroppers who organized the People's Program on Poverty. Here, critics insisted it was encouraging heaped-up, packed-down, and running-over hatred of the white race. In the western part of the state, the fund tried to start a newspaper to publicize the needs of the poor, but critics denounced the project as un-American. They charged the fund with promoting an Appalachian version of Pravda, the official newspaper of the Soviet Union's Communist Party. Similar opposition in communities across the state brought the work of the North Carolina Fund to an end in 1968. The fund did not win a victory over poverty, but the community organizations it established continued to partner with the federal government to fight poverty. They helped push the poverty rate steadily downward, from nearly 40% in 1960 to 12% by the 1990s. The fund also left a rich legacy in the hundreds of men and women it inspired to commit their lives to building a just and prosperous future for our state. Next, here's the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest winner in the elementary division. The contest-winning article is Kids in the 1960s by Anna Ma, who is a member of the Mug T. MES Historians, Underwood G.T. Magnet Elementary School, Glenda Bryson Jacobs advisor. And she's the winner of the 2018 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest Elementary Division. Have you ever wondered what kids did in the 1960s? They did some things that we might even think are downright absurd now. What was typical for the average child of the 60s? Things we do today are very different from back then. First is the regular morning routine. On a normal school day, we get up, make our bed, dress, and eat breakfast. We grab our lunch or lunch money and catch a school bus or carpool to school. In the 1960s, things were similar, but there were some differences. A 60s breakfast could be a sugary cereal, and most would walk to a school with family or friends in their neighborhood. At lunchtime today, we go to the cafeteria and buy a school lunch or eat a packed lunch from home. In the 1960s, kids could run home for a sandwich on Wonder Bread plus some fruit and milk. Some would eat a packed lunch in a metal or plastic lunch box with a thermos for their milk. A hot lunch from the cafeteria was possible in some schools. After school, kids returned home where they completed schoolwork and then asked permission to go out and play. Kids could say, "I'm going to this person or that person's house," or maybe play in the park. Kids hopped on their bikes and went to play. Parents did not worry because everyone knew each other in the neighborhood. Today, many friends live in neighborhoods not close to each other, so walking to their house is too far. Parents arrange play dates. In fact, on weekends, 1960s kids could play all day at a friend's house they were closest to, often drank from the water hose, and did not wear sunscreen. Today, kids are often in organized sports with practices after school and games on Saturdays. In the 1960s, kids were home for dinner, which their mom cooked. Sometimes she might need something from the store, and older kids could run to the store to get what she needed. Maybe if there was change left over, the kids could buy a soda pop. Today, there are a few neighborhood stores. Most people drive to mega supermarkets for groceries. If there are convenience stores in the neighborhood, they usually sell gas, which can make it unsafe for children to walk or bike to because of the cars pulling in and out. Safety is more of a concern now than in the 1960s. Kids could sit anywhere in the car with no reminders to put on your seatbelt. Kids piled into the back of the car or could sit in the front seat. If parents suddenly hit the brake, they would fling out an arm to protect the front seat rider. There were infant seats, but they were not secured, and babies were usually held by a passenger in the car. Today, by law, kids must be in infant seats or booster seats in the rear, and only kids over 14 can sit in the front. Kids often hear their parents or grandparents say, "When I was a kid," or "back in the day." If they're talking about the 1960s, they sometimes speak of the civil rights movement. Especially here in North Carolina, where significant events took place that changed the way things are today. The sit-in movement, the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, or SNCC, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivering his original I Have a Dream speech in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. All of these things led to the March on Washington, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, which impact us today. Being a kid in the 1960s, watching black and white TV, listening to songs by the Beatles was definitely different from today. However, those things did lead to desegregated schools and public places, diverse music, and better child safety. We can be thankful for life in the 1960s for making life better, safer, and more interesting historically today. And here's a closer look. No swimming allowed. Lunch counters were not the only thing segregated before the 1960s. So were movie theaters, schools, beaches, and public swimming pools. On August 7, 1962, six young men, four black and two white, decided to do a swim-in at the whites-only Pullen Park Pool in Raleigh. Some people jumped out. Others, mostly children, stayed in. Finally, the pool was shut down. All public pools in the city were immediately closed until the city council could figure out what to do. And the Pullen Park Pool remained segregated until 1965. The event might seem small compared to big marches on Washington, but it was an important civil rights protest, and young people led the way. What are you reading? Welcome to the club, the Tar Heel Junior Historian Book Club. Have you read a cool book about history lately? Do you have a favorite series? We want to know about it. Check with your advisor to find out the theme of the next Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. Tell us about the book, title and author, and why you like it, and why you think other kids would too, 100 words maximum. It could be fiction, nonfiction, or even a graphic novel. Include a photo of yourself holding the book. Be sure to show us the cover. Ask your advisor to email it to Kathy East, Tar Heel Junior Historian Editor, at Kathy. That's C-A-T-H-Y dot East, E-A-S-T, C-A-T-H-Y dot E-A-S-T at ncdcr.gov. That's Kathy East at ncdcr.gov. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.